Our main speaker tonight is Bob.
That was quick. My name's Bob Darrow, and I am alcoholic. Through the grace of a very loving God who turns out is crazy about me and has no taste, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as they're outlined in the big book, are good sponsorship, commitments to the fellowship, and bushels of newcomers. I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substances for, as you say here, 10,251 days since back. And for that, I'm grateful, and I owe you my life. And if you're new, just so your head will shut off, that's a little over 28 years, because you'll be like a computer trying to figure out pi. It's good to be here. This is what I would consider a pocket of enthusiasm in New York City. This is a bastion of trying to keep the steps and the traditions alive and the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and probably even above all of that, the primary purpose, which is not, oddly enough, if you're new, it's not to help ourselves. It's to help other alcoholics, to help someone other than yourself. There's a line in our book that I rebelled against for a long time. It says, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. And I've always been that way, and I'm that way to this day with over 28 years of abstinence. And obviously, most of you know that I'm bodily different because I have that thing with alcohol, that when I start to feel the effect of alcohol, I have an allergic reaction to the effect. And what that allergic reaction is I need more, I want more of it, and more of it, and more of it, and more of it, and I can't get enough. And if you have that reaction to alcohol and you can't get enough, you're going to be compelled to burn your life to the ground on a regular basis, because if you can't get enough, you're always going to get too much. And that was the story of a lot of my life. But yet, Silkworth says something in The Doctor's Opinion that I've thought about a lot over the years. He says, to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. So I just surround myself by people who drink and do drugs like I do. I surround myself by people who have that allergic reaction. And so I get this illusion that maybe this is normal. And I am mentally different from my fellows, and I don't know it, because I adjust to it and think that my thinking is normal. My thinking is not normal. I'm 28 years sober, and there are times when my thinking is, not only is it not normal, if I were to follow it, it would be really a bad deal for me. I tell you, one of my first glimpses of that, I was sober about a year, and I was having a good day. I just came off work. Nobody was bugging me. Me and the boss are getting along good. Everything's smooth. No problems on the horizon. Went out to dinner with some guys. Going to a meeting. I'm walking into this meeting, and there's this guy, Wade, standing at the door greeting, and he shakes my hand. He looks me right in the eye. He says, Bob, how you doing? How you really doing? And I said, fine. And I went and sat down, and it just started. And it just, what does he know? I thought I was doing all right. Now that I think about it, I don't even feel very good, actually. I just started looking around the room, and everybody's happier than I am. And I just started sinking into this abyss. And what changed? Nothing. Except that the reason I'm mentally different is I have a propensity and an inclination to obsessive self-involvement. And what happens is I stop drinking and I just get myself and my emotions just on me. Like that creature in Alien that attaches itself to your face, you know? It's just, It's so like, I get sober, I'm trying not to drink, I'm trying not to take anything. Okay, sober, I know, I've hurt myself, I can't do this stuff, I'll never do it again, never, never, never. And after a while, I said, Bob, how you doing? Well, I'm hanging in there. And what happens to me is my being, my spirit starts to feel smothered because I'm smothering me with me. And I've been for over seven years, I was a chronic relapser here, and I don't understand what's killing me. I'd sit right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and feel like I'm dying. There's a tremendous phrase that is used in the 12 by 12. It talks about feelings of anxious apartness. A feeling that every alcoholic knows with untreated alcoholism, when your spirit is disconnected and sick, it's that feeling it's all of you, and then there's me. Almost as if, and I'm not talking about drunk, I'm talking about sober is when I feel that. Almost as if there's some invisible yet impenetrable barrier between me and the rest of life. And on the other side of that barrier, I observe people connected to each other and a part of, and they're just, man, they're just happening. And then there's me. I remember, I grew up, it was really unfair, and I raged against this. I never could put it into words until after I was sober a while. But it always seemed to me like there were certain people that everything they touched turned to gold. Their relationships were wonderful. Their job experiences were wonderful. Everything they did was just magic. It was like they had some kind of information or something. I used to suspect that maybe the day I was sick at school, they gave out the information or something. But they had something I didn't have. And they were like, it's like they had really good luck. And some of those people were stupid. I mean, really stupid. They were stupid. They didn't deserve that kind of good luck. They were idiots. They were not cool at all. They were just lame, retarded idiots. And man, their life worked. It didn't just work. It was stellar. And I didn't know what's blocking me from getting everything that they're getting. I know exactly what was blocking me today. It was me. I had too much of me between me and life. I had too much me between me and the power source, the juice in life, this thing that some of the religious people call God. I had too much of me between me and you. And so I was dying of loneliness and a state of separation. And the only thing in my life I ever found that overcame that when I'm just locked up inside of me is about 4 or 5 shots of tequila. And I could come out and play. And I could talk to people. About 7 shots, and I loved everybody. I love you, man. You know, that feeling would just come over me. Like I used to run with a gang of guys. We'd drink together. And I could walk into a bar, a party, and I'm just like a mope. And after about 7 or 8 drinks, man, I'm plugged in. After about 9 drinks, I could see what Buddha saw. You know what I mean? I could see the big picture. I'd start cracking the secrets of the universe, and I'd say stuff that blow my mind. And what's happening there? Why is it that a guy like me who can't talk to people, who can't be funny, who can't fit, it's just a bump on a log, gets about half lit up on liquor, and whatever it was that was blocking me from life itself seemed to dissolve, and I could be a part of. Now, I'm not talking about at the end of my drinking. I'm talking about in the early days, in the days where the magic was there and the hook was set. And if you haven't had that experience, why did you drink yourself into ruin unless you're chasing that magic effect, that miraculous power that I once found in a pint of whiskey? It was wonderful. And I didn't understand that what alcohol did is it relieved me of the bondage of self. Because I go in that bar, I go in that party, and I'm just locked up. Did you ever have the experience when, after a long period of tedious abstinence, you're low-level depressions, and you don't fit anywhere. There's a loneliness that's inexplicable because you could be surrounded by people who care about you, and yet I don't fit really. I would always approach, on my way to get lit up, I would go with an anticipation of freedom, an anticipation of busting out. Now, I don't know that I'm busting out of here. I don't know that the freedom I'm seeking is the freedom from the bondage of self. This thing that happens to me when I stop drinking that makes me mentally and ultimately mentally different from my fellows is because I have a malady of my being. I was just up in Stepping Stones Sunday afternoon. It's about my fifth or sixth time up there. I love going up there. I'm so almost brought to tears being in the presence of things that not just changed my life, but the lives of a lot of people I love. And for countless generations to come, hopefully, if we keep this thing burning, if we keep an enthusiasm for these principles alive, our grandchildren's grandchildren will have relief and freedom from this awful terminal illness. But I'm up there, and on the wall is a letter written to Bill Wilson in the early 1960s. I have a copy of it at home in my big book. It's written from Carl Jung, the great psychiatrist, to Bill Wilson. And there's a line in there that is absolutely true for me. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, it may very well resonate with you as it does with me. And what the line says is that Carl is telling Bill something that he was hesitant to tell Roland Hazard or even talk about. Because you got to remember, back in those days, you didn't want to mix. If you were a scientist in this new thing called psychiatry and psychology, you didn't want to talk about anything religious. There was a big schism there. And Carl said to Bill that he always suspected from his experience with alcoholics like Roland that the alcoholic's thirst for alcohol wasn't really a thirst for alcohol. It was a low-level thirst of his being for unity, for connectedness, or as expressed in medieval religious terms, a union with God. Something inside of me yearned from that from which I was once a part of. And I spent my whole life chasing something that would reconnect me and failed. And when alcohol, the problem with alcohol and combinations of alcohol and other substances is that it works for a while. But alcoholism is a progressive disease. And because it's a progressive disease, what that really means is as the years go on, my ability to get that magic effect gets more and more elusive. And I'm having harder and harder time jump-starting the party, getting back to those good old days. And as that is happening, and the fun and the ease and comfort's deteriorating and going into oblivion, at the same time, the problems are incurring and incurring and incurring, and it's getting worse, and I'm getting more and more trouble, and I'm having problems with the police, and God, the problems within myself, that the moments you come to and you just wish you were dead. I was a blackout. Any blackout drinkers in here? Oh, yeah. My people. It's hard going through life when other people know more about you than you do. That's not good... And if you're like me, nobody ever came up to you the next day and said, "Oh, Bob, you were so helpful at the party." You peed in our kitchen. You hit on my wife. You broke my lamp. You stole my stash. You sideswiped my car. One morning, I'm sick and I need a drink, and I'm on my way to the state store in Pennsylvania, and a guy comes up and he says, "Do you know you told everybody at the party last night you beat Bruce Lee in a karate match?" Oh, I want to crawl under a rock. Right? this is like getting bad here. And yet, I am full of self-delusion. And what is, the big book talks about self-delusion. If you just came out of treatment, they were telling you about denial. Let me tell you something. If we could get it down to denial, it would be manageable. But it's worse than denial. This delusion, it's a psychotic, wishful thinking. It's all the evidence is that this stuff's killing me. But I want it to be fun again so bad, I'll start imagining it's going to be when all the evidence is it's turned on me, it's not fun anymore. But I want it to be like it was when I was 18 years old, so desperately. And why? Because without it, I'm nothing. I'm nothing. I don't fit anywhere. My emotional nature is all screwed up. I don't feel like other people look. I suffer in this. It's the suffering, this restless, irritable, discontented suffering that I experience when I get sober. It's a subtle, vague thing. It goes right below the radar, and it just kind of gnaws away at you. There's a uselessness about my life sober, and a loneliness that's just awful. And it's a loneliness that no relationship will cure. No friends will cure, nothing will cure, because it is right in the core. It's right in the core of who I am. So I drink. I drink years past the point where it's fun. I drink into the bleak, pathetic years, the years where it's turned on me, and now it's when I go out to party, it is not a party. And at the very end, I pretty much prefer to drink alone. My idea of a party is the hole up in some place with about 2 half gallons of vodka and seek oblivion and just blot it out. And I don't bathe anymore because once the magic's gone, I don't care about nothing really. I don't care about me. All pretense is gone in my life. You know, the years of dressing up and throwing on some cologne and going out to some kind of... It's pointless. Because I don't fit there no more. Alcohol's turned on me. And the one thing that allowed me to mix and fit with people, now I drink and I'm lonely. I drink and I feel a self-pity. I drink and go on crying drags. I drink and I feel I'm pathetic. And isn't it funny that that is reality for me? And yet, even though that's real, this self-delusion, after 10 or 11 months of abstinence, I will start imagining on my way to get a jug or a party, I'm going to imagine it's going to be like it was when I was 18 years old, when the evidence is overwhelming that it hasn't been that way for years and it ain't going to be that way no more. And I'm that way because there's something wrong with me. And I get sober, and I got sober in 1978 at a time in a city and a time when it's not like it is today. And you hear some of the old timers talk about the good old days. I don't think they were. I'll tell you something. I got sober at a time when nobody did the steps out of this book. You could go to most of the cities in the state I lived in. You could go to the oldest old timer in that town and say, how do you work a 4-step? And he'd send you to a 12-by-12 study group. People had lost touch with this. There weren't groups like this keeping it alive. There weren't groups like my home group in Las Vegas keeping it alive. And it was desolate. And I got sober, and I don't know what to do, and I don't have a treatment for alcoholism. So in 1978, when I got sober, I didn't know what else to do. I was scared. I really wanted it to be different. And so I went to 15 and 20 meetings a week. I prayed, even though I didn't believe in God. I did it. I got on my knees, did what those people told me to do. I did a lot of 12-step work. I said yes to every commitment in AA that came on the horizon. I was everything in AA. I was secretary, a GSR, an intergroup rep. I was area officer. I was DCM. I was roundup on every position on our convention committee and another convention committee and eventually chairman of both of those, as if I could outrun my alcoholism. But Chamberlain used to talk about a point that every alcoholic gets to. A place where you can no longer put anything between you and you. And now the shine of all that stuff is you're at the end of your rope, and now I'm sober several years, and I keep battling these depressions. I keep waking up afraid. I worry. I'm tired. It's wearing me out. I'm tired all the time. And I don't know why I seem like I'm running the show, and yet this doesn't make sense because I get down on my knees every single morning and turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And 10 minutes later, I'm in my head running the universe. I'm in my head judging everything. I'm in the head, in my inside of me, incurring, like tightening up a spring that's just making me crazy. And I don't know how not to do it. Because what I'm really doing is I'm trying to give God my life, but I have retained my will, which is my judgment of my life. And if you do that, and I did it because I didn't know how to dismantle the judgment machine. I hadn't worked the fourth step out of the book. I hadn't made the amends. I hadn't done anything. So I'm still locked in being right about a lot of stuff. And I hadn't seen where I was wrong. I hadn't dismantled the judgment machine yet. And so I'm nuts. And if you try to give your life to God and you retain your judgment of your life, it's like saying, here, God, here's my life. But there's a list coming of how it better go. And you know what depression is? That's when God stops doing your will. I mean, you know. So I was depressed a lot. You know? You know, I tell you, I revisited a lot of my religion in my childhood, and I'm not into. My deal, my spiritual path is Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'll tell you something. In the light of my own awakening here from those steps, a lot of that stuff from a lot of different religions makes sense now, when it didn't make sense before. And I revisited the story that I heard as a little kid about creation, about how God created the heavens and the earth, and then he Adam and Eve, and he created this place for them that was supposedly heaven on earth, called the Garden of Eden. And it was heaven. It was paradise. It was perfect. He told them, you can do anything you want. Just enjoy yourself. Have a good time. We make a suggestion, kind of like your sponsor makes a suggestion. Don't go with her. You know, makes a suggestion. Make a suggestion. Don't eat the fruit of that one particular tree. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You know what I think happened? And I am not a biblical scholar. And there's probably people here know more about this than I do, but this is what I imagine in the light of my own awakening. I think they ate that fruit and they got the knowledge of good and evil. And all of a sudden Adam's sitting there going, you know, just yesterday I thought this was paradise. God, Eve's got cellulite. What the hell are you thinking? There's crabgrass. There's mosquitoes. This place is crap. And what happened? What changed? Nothing. Except the same thing changed for them, I think, that changes for me in here. When I could be sitting in my home group, and I'm at one with everybody, and then it's like a key turns in my head. And it's not that I'm becoming judgmental, but I am noticing some things about some people here. And it's a little irritating, and I'm a little restless, so I need to tell them about these things, which makes it lonely here. And what changed? Nothing. My sponsor talks about alcoholism being a disease of perception. Chamberlain told a story one time. He said, talked about sitting in this chair, coming off a drunk, in this house, married to that woman, working at that place, and he felt like he was dying. He said he felt like he was in hell. Years later, after working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, he said he found himself sitting in the same chair in the same house, married to the same woman, working in the same place, and he had tears in his eyes because he felt like he was in heaven. And he said, maybe heaven's just a new pair of glasses. And the only thing that has separated me from my inheritance here on this planet has been me. And I believe from my experience that Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to do one thing. It's designed to get my life out of the hands of an idiot. Right? That's it. And if you're new, If you're new, your family, or anyone that's loved you and watched you the last couple years, probably has easily come to the conclusion that the people that watched me came to, that whoever's making decisions for this person is out to kill them. And yet, isn't it funny that in here, in this driven vacancy life, driven to gratify and fulfill and rest happiness and satisfaction out of this world, isn't it amazing that driven by all that, yeah, I can't see that? I feel like a victim. I feel like people are doing stuff to me. I don't see that I'm the guy. And I didn't see that until after I did the fourth step out of the big book. And then I started to get free. The longer I'm sober, it's funny how I came here in 1978 I had this big view of recovery. Like it was all good. I worked my first year in a treatment center as an alcoholism drug abuse counselor, and I liked it all. I liked the TA and the RET, and it's all good. It's all good. It's all good. And then it's funny, after the years go by, and I walk over the dead bodies of men and women who I've loved, who have done all that other stuff, just from nothing else except a process of elimination. This seems to be what's left, is the thing that seems to carry the most of us to a place of freedom from the thing that we didn't even know was killing us, a thing called alcoholism, the thing that really starts where the bottle and the bag ends. And isn't that really my problem? It looks like alcohol's my problem, because every time I drink it, I burn my life to the ground. But the problem really is I can't stop from starting, because I get so sick in sobriety that I'm driven back to that by the emotions and the loneliness and the desolation of my life. In 1978, after a failed suicide attempt, I ended up once more in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got a sponsor. And I got a home group, and I started. I tried to outrun this disease until I got to my fourth year, and then by this time I'd been to a Joe and Charlie workshop. I tell you, oddly enough, before I did the steps out of the book, I'd actually helped a guy I sponsored do a four-step in here before I'd ever did it the way it is in here, and he started doing better than me, and I really don't like that at all. And I started to do this thing in here, and it started to change my life. I belong to a group. If you ever come to Las Vegas, it's called the Specific Group. Everybody thinks it's named after the Pacific Group. It's actually Clancy at the convention last weekend said, he said, this is Bob from the Specific Group. We call him Splancy. I tell you, if you're new and you can't stand abuse, stay away from the old timers. Stay away from them. They'll think stuff's funny about you that you don't think's funny at all. I mean, and they get a lot of not only they'll think it's funny, they'll want to bring their friends over. I mean, they'll get a lot of enjoyment out of it. If you're ever in Las Vegas, my name's in the book. Because I believe in the principle, if I'm really going to have a primary purpose here, I have to be available. Within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous only, I give my last name. Because if one of you comes to Vegas on a business trip and you lose all your money and you're thinking about drinking and you remember Bob, I'll tell you, if you call information and ask for Bob with the blonde hair, you're not going to get me. My last name is Darryl. I'm in the phone book and I'm available. Because that's what we do here. We're available to each other. I will never break my anonymity at a public level, but I want to be available, just as I want you to be available to me. If you share something in a meeting and all of a sudden I'm going through it, I want to know how to get a hold of you. I have a good life today. It's not my fault. It's really not. I just bought another home. I'm a little grandiose. I don't just buy houses. I buy... And I'm looking to buy another one on the island of Maui. And I got to retire a couple years ago. You know, it's funny. I just, in my heart, I just yearned. I was tired of this business. He was making a lot of money. I was tired of it. I just thought, you know, all I want to do is help God's kids. I just like to be able to do AA. And all of a sudden, from the moment of that desire in my heart, the universe started arranging itself to make that possible. And I was able to retire and retire very well. And it all started with my joining you. I'll tell you a quick little story and this will end. 17 years ago, I was in an AA event in Northern California, right up near the Oregon border. And I had a day with nothing to do after the event was over. I had a late flight out. So this guy that's my host is driving me around showing me stuff. And he takes me to this forest where they had these trees that were like 250, 300 feet high. Some of these trees, 25, 30 feet in diameter. Blew my mind. It was like Jurassic Park. It was amazing. And I'm walking around there just in awe. And then we get in his truck and we're driving over to see some more stuff. He wants to show me. And we're driving by these fields and meadows. And he says to me, he says, you notice how you don't see a 250, 300 foot tree in a meadow all by itself? I said, yeah. He says, you know why that is? I said, no. Why is that? He said, well, it is their nature to aspire to grow to such magnificent heights that they literally will outgrow their roots capacity to support themselves, and they'll literally topple over on their own aspired magnificence. What must happen is that they must, to survive, grow up in community, and they intertwine the roots with each other in a net below the floor of the forest, and they literally hold and support each other up, and that allows them to grow into their nature. And when he said that, I thought to myself, oh my God, that's what is exactly what has happened to me. I have had an inherent character defect that all but destroyed me. And what that is that I've always yearned for more. I've always been the guy that wanted to take bigger bites out of life. I was a driven kind of guy for more. And by myself alone, that almost destroyed me. And I was so broken by alcoholism, and I'm not a joiner. The problem I have with AA is it's full of people. But I was so broken by alcoholism, I came here and I did some things that I normally wouldn't have done. I got a sponsor. I got a home group. Eventually, I started sponsoring people. I started having commitments and being involved in service. I literally combined the foundation of my life with yours. And you've allowed me to grow into my nature. And if I live to be 1,000 years old, I can never repay you. Thank you for my life.